EMI present the outstanding man of music, the one and only David Bowie, with his hit album, Tonight. I'm gonna write a poem in a letter. Tonight features his current single, plus Blue Jean and seven other great new tracks. Get David Bowie at his best. Get David Bowie tonight.
Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And I'm really glad you're back, as in this episode, we royally round off our Tonight Talk with the man of words and man of music, author of the complete David Bowie, Nicholas Pegg. In this final part of the talk, we're taking on the last few tracks of the album, from Tumble and Twirl to Dancing with the Big Boys. And then we step back to reflect on the highs and lows of this curious little album, and consider that while Bowie was really an innate experimenter, sometimes experiments don't always work. It's fine, but experiments still need to happen. Otherwise, he's just stuck doing the same thing over and over again. Anyway, so here we are. It's the last part of our conversation on Tonight, and I hope you enjoy.
Okay, so
Tumble and Twirl.
Now, cards on the table. I love this one. For me, this is tonight's bona fide underrated gem.
Really?
Absolutely, yes.
This is your underrated gem on this album?
It is. This is my underrated gem on this album. Okay. No, I don't mean... I'm not saying it's better than Loving the Alien and Blue Jean. I'm just saying this is...
One can have underrated gems.
This is not one that I'm going to give a kicking to. It's not perfect because it is very... You know, we mentioned Kid Creole and the Coconuts and Wham earlier on, and there's a kind of a... Ooh, there's lots of trumpets going boop, boop, and things in it, and it is a little bit Kid Creole and the Coconuts with its Latino rhythms and stuff. You know, it's very 1984. Nothing wrong with Kid Creole and his coconuts. But no, look, I do...
Not at all. Mr. Creole and his coconuts were loved by many, many people.
Indeed. I do genuinely. This is a really... I love this one. I mean, first up, Carlos Alomar. Just try listening to this track and just zone into the guitar and just listen to him go. I'm in Carlos heaven. This is a man, as we know, who played those wonderful riffs on things like Fame and Golden Years and all the rest of it. You know, for in Bowie terms, I suppose kind of we're getting towards late period Carlos, but he's great. He's still got it. He's amazing. Of course, he's still got it now. He's a genius, man. He's wonderful. So that's lovely. It's lovely to hear Carlos really having something to get his teeth into. It's a track which, as a piece of songwriting and as an arrangement, I think, you know, it attempts a sort of quite an interesting clash of musical cultures, perhaps in the vein of looking back to Lodger on Red Sails and African Night Flight.
There's definitely that Lodger vibe.
Yeah, here. Yeah. And in fact, I think lyrically, it is in some ways a kind of quite close descendant of African Night Flight.
Yes.
That same or similar idea of the rather forlorn expats, you know, holed up in colonial exile somewhere in the far-flung, you know, in this case, in the forests of Southeast Asia. As we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, Bowie and Iggy took a holiday in Indonesia after the end of the Sirius Moonlight Tour. And this song kind of commemorates that because it's, you know, obviously it's fictionalized. And apparently they wrote the lyric. The lyric was a collaboration between the two of them, but Iggy kind of took the lead on this and his crazy free associating mind came up with all these things and put them together in the way that they work in the song. I'm sure we all remember that amazing, wonderfully funny, rambling anecdote that Bowie told to Chris Evans on TFI Friday once in about 1999 about when he got gastroenteritis in the jungle when he was the guest of a rich millionaire who lived in a colonial house in the jungle in Asia. Well, that is what this song is talking about. It's referring to this holiday after the Sirius Moonlight Tour. They went and stayed with this guy, and clearly it was a memorable episode.
So that performance on TFI Friday wasn't just some random stream of consciousness. It actually linked into
trip. I mean, the reason he went off on it on that Chris Evans show was that I think he had just had gastroenteritis again, hadn't he, in 1999. Then he said, I had it before, you know, and that's where it all came out. And he's talking about this. He's talking about the events that are in some small way commemorated in Tumble and Twirl on the Tonight album.
And can't you tell the guest songwriters are still doing the rounds?
Do you know how I got that?
Go on.
I was in Indonesia. I was lost in the jungle. This is absolutely true. What?
I believe you.
Yeah. And an old man with one leg and a donkey found me and took me to a glade and pointed to a temple and a palace. And I said, I'm not Muslim. Wife is, I'm not. So we're going to the palace. You're going to let me go on with this, aren't you?
I'm dead right, mate. You started it.
We got to the palace and it's the son of, I think he was a gun runner. And he had guys in turrets all around the palace with guns to keep the poor people out. He was so pleased to see me that he put a sheet up in the garden at the bottom of the garden, pouring with rain.
Yeah.
Servants holding a sheet up at the far end of the garden, had a projector on the porch where we were, and we sat and watched Sahara with Brooke Shields. Then he threw a party and he had seven daughters and seven sons.
Yeah.
I always laugh when I say that bit. And the seven daughters, they entertained me royally with dance and flute playing. Flute playing and dance. And he fed me things like monkey breast and parrot beak, I think it was. It was the course that night. And the next day, I redecorated the bathroom. But he sent his daughter over to me.
Yeah.
His favourite daughter, he sent to me. If you know what I mean.
Yes.
And I couldn't make it to the front door. Go away! You're beautiful, but go away. This was many years ago. That has nothing... This has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that I got gastroenteritis the other day. That was just... It just reminded me, though, that I've had it twice.
So, I've got a quote again from Bowie from 84, talking about this song. He said, the very rich oil magnates of Java have these incredible colonial-style houses with sewage floating down the hills into the jungle. So it's like, you know, glorious luxury, yeah. And yet underneath is the sewage. And that stayed with me. And watching films out in the garden projected onto sheets, it felt so bizarre to sit there in the jungle watching movies at the end of the garden through the monsoon weather with the rain pouring down, images of Brooke Shields. It was quite absurd. So that's really interesting. And then you look at the lyric, and it's about this chap called Leon, incidentally, a character name that Bowie would then return to on Outside.
Exactly.
But yes. Leon's got this place in Borneo. And things are all, you know, this kind of quite sort of upbeat stuff about him and his house. And then you get to this sort of middle eight vocal bit. And this is so Iggy, isn't it? You suddenly get this bit where these backing singers all sing, again, in a rather old-fashioned sort of 1940s almost harmony. Far beneath his mansion, there's an open drain sending all the sewage down the hill. And then it goes back to the kid drill and the coconuts bit again. And it's a funny song.
When you start approaching it from that angle, it's incredibly funny and satirical. The lyrics are brilliant. You know, well, I've been to Leon's. He's got nine daughters and a stereo. Leon watches from the treetops in Borneo, where the rain is mud. Everything stops with a thud. That's the way it goes down yonder in Borneo. You know, this is clearly a wonderfully satirical song. And he's also snarking at, like you said, like the tourists or the expats who just superficially engage with the place and with the people there.
That's right. Yeah.
And it is wonderful. Do you know, I'm sure you do know, that the bass
now
on
this is a
Tumble and Twirl.
This is interesting, isn't it? This is interesting.
The bass is...
Well, when you listen to Tumble and Twirl, you hear this very idiosyncratic, very choppy bass that doesn't sound like anything else on the album. And you think, do you know, that sounds a bit like... And then you go and look on the internet and you see that in interviews a couple of times over the years, a very, very famous bass player has said, yeah, I did a track for Bowie once. I can't really remember much about it. And I can't even, I don't even know what it was. And then you go back and you listen to it and you said, it's this. It's Mark King from Level 42.
Mark King.
It sounds so like him. He has testified that he did once play for Bowie. The weird thing is that he was already successful and well known. Their famous massive hits hadn't quite happened yet, but The Sun Goes Down was a top 10 hit in 83. He'd had quite a few hits before that. So he wasn't some nobody session person. And yet he's not credited on the album. I asked Carmine Rojas about this, actually, who, of course, was the principal bass player on this album, and said, you know, what's that? And Carmine said, well, yeah, I think so. It's certainly not me. That's what he said. So he had heard this as well, and he thinks it is. It's a bit of a mystery, and not least because Mark King can't remember what. So imagine playing for David Bowie and not knowing what track it was.
Was he maybe drugged and then flown to Canada overnight and then deposited at Le Studio, did a take, and then taken back into a plane and flown back to the Isle of Wight, and where he continued as a member of Level 42? Because everyone's being very, very shifty and furtive about this. Like you say, Carmine's like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Mark King. Well,
Carmine wasn't being shifty about it. He was just saying, I obviously don't know, but I can tell you
it's not me. Indulge me. Just
you want this to be some kind of spy story.
Some big spy story. Well, I have a quote from the Padge, Hugh Padgham, and he confirms that Mark King was on it. As far as I remember, Iggy only came up to the studio for about a week after the break in the recording sessions. All the backing tracks had been done, so Iggy had come mainly to help David write lyrics, as far as I remember. Maybe they wrote lyrics tumble and twirl then. The other thing about that song is that Mark King played the bass on it and didn't get a credit, which I presume was a contractual thing.
There we are then, from the horse's mouth. I didn't realise that he had actually confirmed that. Oh, there we are. Mystery solved.
Yeah. So you were quite right as well. I mean, Carlos Alomar did this fantastic arrangement.
Yeah.
The Borneo horns, I think, were arranged by him. And it just really, really makes this track pop in the best possible way. Just let's touch on something very briefly now. So Padgham here refers to there was a break in recording sessions. This is when Padgham says he got a call during that break to ask him if he could take over production techniques. So what happened there?
Well, again, this is somewhat shrouded in mystery, probably because people have just been kind and not wanted to sort of overheat something that doesn't need overheating. But evidently, there was a bit of a falling out at some stage in the studio with Derek Bramble, the original producer. Now, Carlos has talked about this, and I think Hugh Padgham has talked about it. Inexperienced as he was, Derek Bramble thought that he had to do lots of takes, because that's the way a lot of artists do it. You know, they do multiple takes and then choose their favorite one. As we know, as David Bowie acolytes, that was anathema to David. David was a huge fan of the first take. If the first take was a complete mess, of course he'd do a second take. But if the first take had the spontaneity and energy and maybe had a couple of strange moments that weren't, he actually liked the bumps. But he was also technically such a brilliant singer quite often the first take was perfect. And apparently it got to the stage when they were recording vocals, which of course is after, generally speaking, after they'd recorded backing tracks. So this is next stage of the recording sessions, really. Derek Bramble kept asking for safety takes, basically. And it started really frustrating, not just David, but everyone. You know, Carlos, as he remembers this bit, thinking, why are you asking for another one? That was perfect. What do you want another one for? So this happened anyway. Quite how things may or may not have, you know, escalated, we probably will never quite know. But anyway, with a forcibly or by mutual agreement, Derek Bramble stepped down as producer. And
he stepped down.
And Hugh Padgham, who had up until this point been the engineer, but, you know, he had said, I mean, I think Hugh Padgham had said that, you know, before Derek actually left, it had already got to the stage that he and Bowie were kind of siding against Derek, shall we say, you know, that sort of thing. It was the two of them against this inexperienced producer who was making bad calls.
Bizarre situation. Yeah. Do you know of any other situation during Bowie's recording lifetime, a similar kind of situation happening?
I can't really think of one. No, not really. No, if any tiffs that one can think of were more to do with, you know, contractual, you know, for example, the sad sacking of Stevie Ray Vaughan at the beginning of the Serious Moonlight Tour, but that was to do with his manager being outrageous and demanding, you know, trying to sort of basically blackmail them about money, and that wasn't going to wash. But that was nothing to do with the process. And Bowie loved Stevie Ray Vaughan's work on the album. It was very sad indeed that he wasn't on the tour. No, I can't really think of another example of something like this particularly happening.
Here we have this artist who's, you know, a good 16 years into a recording career, who is very collaborative by nature, who sparks off people he chooses to surround himself with. He prides himself on his ability to select people to work with. And you get to a point where this producer essentially leaves the project halfway through, which isn't really a very David Bowie thing to happen.
No, it's not. It's not. It's, yes. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, obviously, it, you know, without wanting to over-dramatized. It must have been important enough that, you know, clearly the situation had become untenable or intolerable in some way, because otherwise they would have probably just gritted their teeth and got on with it. But it obviously went beyond that. So Hugh Padgham, who came in with the demotion as agreeing to be engineer, finds himself ultimately the producer of the album after all. And on the final album as released, you'll see that it has three credited producers: David Bowie, Derek Bramble, and Hugh Padgham. So, you know, Derek Bramble's contribution to the album is not nothing. He made a significant contribution to it, but I think possibly more as a player than as a producer.
Yes.
You know.
Definitely.
And so Hugh Padgham was there for the final stages, for the vocals and for the mixing and the rest of it. His influence on the album, whilst not 100%, is probably ultimately, you know, more significant than it would otherwise have been. Mm. Yeah.
And Padgham has said over the years that he feels that had he been there from the start in the producer's job, I mean, obviously he would say that, but he has put it on record a couple of times that the album isn't the best album there is.
Yeah.
And had I been there from the beginning, I would have kind of urged Bowie to go a little bit more left field. You know, he was talking about the demos that Bowie turned up with, which Alomar, I think Carlos Alomar had just said, wow, I've never seen David show up with prepared demos like this. You know, normally there's a far more organic studio-based process. But Padgham did say, well, you know, he will do these songs like Blue Jean. And if he had, you know, had me from the beginning, yeah, which is a fair point. I mean, you know, clearly Bramble's way of working, much younger man, coming from, you know, a different background in terms of the kind of pop records he was producing, not really understanding that, yes, David One Take Bowie is a man who works in a certain way and has his ways of doing things. So that's why I was intrigued as to how this decision must have been made and whether Bowie alarm bells were ringing for Bowie saying that this project is really not going well. And what do we do? You know, do I call up Visconti? Do I call up Niall? You know, no. I just have to get Padgham into the hot seat.
Yeah. Which, I mean, that actually is a very Bowie sort of way of dealing with the situation, I think, isn't it? It's kind of looking around his immediate environment and going, what's the best thing that can happen out of the resources available to me? The best thing that can happen is that guy who has been really good can take
over.
You know, that rather than falling back on phoning someone up who I haven't seen for 6 months, this guy here knows what he's doing. And of course, also, Padgham had been there from the start of the album, so he kind of knew his way around the songs and what the project was. He did know what they were. It wasn't going to be a total, you know, parachuting in a brand new person at that stage of the things. Might have ended up with even more of a messy album. We'll never know, of course, as you say, what would have happened if the Padge had been in the hot seat from the word go. But
did he work with Padgham again? I think he mentioned this earlier.
He did.
He did.
Take this how you will, but Hugh Padgham's other opportunity to work with David Bowie came on the Tin Machine 2 album, which was another album of highs and lows, I think we can say. You know, I love bits of Tin Machine 2, and
me too.
And then there are some other bits that I don't love as much. But yeah, Hugh Padgham was on that album. What's that? Not quite 10 years later.
92? Was that 91?
Came out in 91. So actually, yeah.
91,
yeah. So in fact, only about 7 years later. So those were the two. He wasn't in it for the whole process, because of course quite a lot of what was on the Tin Machine 2 album was stuff left over from the first Tin Machine sessions, and which they sort of polished up and reworked and added vocals and what have you. But he did produce, I think, Lock, Stock and Barrel, One Shot, for example, which is a very good song. It's one of the highlights of that album. I mean, the second Tin Machine album is a lot more sort of conventionally polished than the first, isn't it?
It's more fully formed.
Isn't it? It's got, you know, songs like Baby Universal and You Belong in Rock and Roll have got a sheen to them, a producer's sheen that I'm sure Hugh Padgham had something to do with, which you don't really see on or hear on the first Tin Machine album.
Mm.
Yeah, so those were his two projects with Bowie, really. Neither of them, for many people, huge highlights of Bowie's career, but interesting albums to work on, I'm sure.
Interesting albums to work on, and I think the sense of frustration that he's expressed in interviews about Tonight probably would have informed the way that he approached Tin Machine 2. So we would have been, okay, guys, you know, I want this, you know, because you take that outburst, which was Tin Machine 1, and like you say, Tin Machine 2 was far more producery.
Yes, yes.
You know, far more layering and texture, and, you know, you could sense a lot more work had gone into it from the producer's chair.
Yes.
as opposed to Tin Machine 1, which was very much an explosion kind of captured by a producer.
Which was, of course, that was, of course, part of the whole point of it, wasn't it? That
they part of the whole point of it, exactly. Right, okay, so moving on to another cover version. So this is kind of like almost, you know, 9 years on from Pinups. This is almost becoming like Pinups Part 2, but this is a delightfully obscure track, I Keep Forgetting.
I Keep Forgetting, yeah. Forgetting you don't love me. Jackson,
Lieber and Stoller.
Who was a very handsome young singer who had a few hits around about this time. Lieber and Stoller, of course, you know, the great, one of the great songwriting duos, Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Yakety Yak, Stand By Me, that amazing Peggy Lee song, Is That All There Is? They wrote hundreds of amazing famous songs, and among them, they wrote a slightly less well-known, I Keep Forgetting, which was a hit, I think it was a hit in America, whether it was a hit, anyway, it was a single in 62. I keep forgetting you don't love me no more. Forgetting you don't want me no more. I keep forgetting about those heartbreaking nights and those heartbreaking dreams that you said. Though I know in my heart we're drifting apart, still I can't believe our love is dead.
It was a top 55
hit. Well, there we go. Exactly. So it was Tonight for David Bowie. But there we are. Yeah. We are now talking about the sort of 12, 13, 14-year-old David Bowie, aren't we? Because this is, it's one of his sort of pin-ups type numbers. And the same year that Chuck Jackson did this song, 1962, he also recorded the Bacharach David song, Any Day Now. And in fact, Any Day Now was the title of the Chuck Jackson album that had, I Keep Forgetting, on it. I assume David had that album when he was a kid, or maybe he just had the singles, because Any Day Now is a very famous song. It was later covered by Presley and Scott Walker and various people. And of course, Bowie kind of alludes to it or quotes it on Diamond Dogs. You know, Any Day Now, the year of the Diamond Dog. They've got nothing to do with the song, but that phrase, Any Day Now, is there. And so I think Chuck Jackson might have had a little bit of an influence on the boy Bowie. So yeah, it's another cover version of an oldie from the 60s. And again, I think we can happily agree that it is musically proficient.
Everybody starts and stops at the right time. Yes.
Unlike the Beach Boys cover, though, I do actually think this is quite fun. It's as sharp as a pin. It's you know, really nicely delivered. I mean, okay, it's a throwaway, but it's a great throwaway. I'm not going to be rude about this track. I think it's rather fun. It has, I say, marimba. It was wonderful. Great stuff. It's got marimbas, it's got trumpets, it's got Kid Creole and his coconuts. They're back again. So, no, I love it.
I'm sensing you like it.
It's all right. It's all right. Look, it's not on my turntable every day or even every month, but it's all right. I'm not going to be rude about this. It'd be like taking food away from a puppy. It's fine. It's lovely.
Well, let's keep the puppy fed. I mean, I have very little to say about this. I also find it perfectly pleasant and inoffensive. There's a nice quote from Charles Shaw Murray's interview with David from The NME, where Murray told Bowie that the reinterpretation of I Keep Forgetting is masterful, to which Bowie says, oh, good. Oh, you like that. I've always wanted to do that song. I think that this album gave me the chance, like Pinups did a few years ago, to do some covers that I always wanted to do. There we go.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, well, there we are. Yeah.
Exactly. Charles Shaw Murray wrote a very famous review, Damning Low, on its release.
He did indeed,
So for Bowie, that sense of relief and surprise was probably, more probably than not, very, very genuine. Yeah. Oh, you like that? Wonderful.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. And then that leads us into our last track, the leitmotif of this album. It's an Iggy track.
So yeah, this is another of the sort of new ones, is Bowie Pop. And
this is a new one.
Carlos also contributed to this. So it's Bowie Pop, yes. Alamar. But yeah, like Tumble and Twirl, this is a new collaborative piece of songwriting for this album. So it is one of the new tracks. Is it?
pretty short, energetic.
It is. It's energetic. It's it has Iggy on backing vocals very noticeably as well, actually. Mm. I think this is kind of, I was going to say it's the odd one out on the album, but you can say that about several tracks on the album, because as we've already said, it is a bit scattered, this album. But it's in the sense that I think this one is sort of rougher, rockier, harsher, yes, than the rest of the, yeah, album. It's definitely, you know, we've talked many times before about each album having a sort of bridge track to the next album. This is absolutely pointing the way to Never Let Me Down, isn't it? This is, you know, for better or worse, that's where we're headed now. It's got that more sort of urban, slightly edgier, slightly sort of rougher around the edges sound to it. Yeah, I mean, there's a Bowie quote about that, actually. I think he said, wherever I've got it here somewhere. Yes, look, he says, there's a particular sound I'm after that I haven't really got yet, and I probably won't drop this search until I get it. I think I got quite close to it on Dancing with the Big Boys. That was quite an adventurous bit of writing, yeah, in the sense that we didn't look for any standards. I got very musical over the last couple of years. I stayed away from experimentation. But in Big Boys, Iggy and I just broke away from all that for the one track. That came nearer to the sound that I was looking for than anything. I'd like to try maybe one more set of pieces like that. Well, there you go. It's kind of is
interesting. Yeah.
So it is, yeah, sort of the bridge into Never Let Me Down. It's
what do you think he was talking? What do you think he meant specifically when that came nearer to the sound I was looking for? I mean, the production.
I think it's a bit about the production, but it's also about, I mean, coming at the end of this album, Dancing with the Big Boys. I mean, yes, it's still got lots of, you know, backing vocals and things going on, but it's noticeably devoid of plinky plonky marimbas and saxophones and things. It's far less adorned with this and that. It's very guitar-y. It's very guitar-led. I don't think it's tremendously successful as a sound. It doesn't quite gel. It feels a bit almost a bit demo-y to me, but maybe that's a good thing.
Yes. You know?
Maybe that's a good thing. It was, by the way, it was the B-side of Blue Jean, the first single, which suggests to me that Bowie favoured it and wanted it to be heard and out there, you know, because yeah, and it's another sort of social alienation lyric, loneliness in a free society, is the way. It's a nice attempt. I have to say, it sort of leaves me a bit cold, this number. It doesn't really hit the spot for me. I can admire it, but it doesn't sort of turn me on that much, to be honest with you.
I was more intrigued by the circumstances of its creation. So again, this was when Iggy came in for a few days. And I don't know if it's from Hugh Padgham or someone else, but there's this idea that they were just standing around a microphone, more or less freestyling. Because a lot of these lyrics, I mean, I could well be wrong. A lot of these lyrics are, you know, they're kind of similar to those cut-ups that he was doing around the time of Diamond Dogs. Talking about a hands-on policy, death to the trees. They were bad. They weren't brave. Nothing is embarrassing. There are too many people, too much belief. Where there's trouble, there's poetry. Your family is a football team. This dot marks your location. You know, you can imagine the scissors have been working overtime.
Yeah, it is quite out there. And I think that probably is also part of what he was talking about a news. Because again, you look forward to Never Let Me Down, and a song like, I don't know, Time Will Crawl has very sort of cut-up-y feel to the lyrics again. Yeah, interesting. One bit that you quoted there, too many people, too much belief. Have you ever heard that early snippet from an early take of the song Scary Monsters that Tony Visconti has played, I think, because
is that everyone's people are turning to gold?
That was a working title for Ashes to Ashes. But no, there's a Scary Monsters bit where it's just a little chorus there. So in this song, we have too many people, too much belief. In that early version of Scary Monsters, it's Scary Monsters, Super Creeps, too many people, too many teeth, which is quite similar. So that's interesting. So yeah, I think you're dead right. It is a very cut-up-y free association, word association. It's like they were batting it back and forth. And I quite like it. I do quite like it. It doesn't really rock my world, but it's okay. Mm. Another interesting thing about this song is that other than the three singles, Blue Jean, Loving the Alien and Tonight, this is the only other track from this album that Bowie did actually take on stage and perform live. He did it on he did it on the Glass Spider tour, but none of the other tracks, you know, were things that he got up and did on stage. So yeah, Dancing with the Big Boys was on the Glass Spider tour. An interesting little anecdote about it, actually, is that, as you know, on Glass Spider he had this wonderful troupe of extraordinary avant-garde New York dancers, and when they were auditioning to be on it, they apparently sent in videos, you know, audition tapes for David to look at, and the dancer Victor Manuel, who's the very tall guy in the sort of fishnets and high heels and long hair, looking very sort of very striking. He danced on his audition take two, dancing with the big boys, and did a kind of free association, crazy improvised dance. And apparently, when Bowie saw this video, he said, "Who's this boy? I've got to have him. I'm having him. Bring him in." And not only did Bowie hire him on the basis of that thing, but when they did Dancing with the Big Boys on stage in On the Glass Water, which sadly, of course, does not appear on the video. It had been dropped from the tour by that stage. It was to begin with, they had quite a few more songs from Never Let Me Down and other oldies that then halfway through the tour, Bowie kind of slimmed it down a bit and discarded a few numbers, which he often did on a tour. And that was one of the casualties, sadly. But anyway, when they did Dancing with the Big Boys, Victor Manuel did his dance. He basically did his audition piece. That was part of the Glass Spider show because Bowie loved
this. No way.
Yeah. Yeah. So Bowie was performing it and he was doing this crazy, improvised, mad, whatever it was, dance. Yeah. Just on his own, sort of doing a mad thing. And because Bowie loved it so much, he said, "Do that. Do the thing you did in your audition." And he did
it. Fantastic.
Night after night. Yeah. And so again, that's a kind of rather lovely, you know, we think of Glass Spider as maybe being a bit scripted and a bit sort of, that was Bowie just going, "I really like that thing that you did. Go over there and do it every night on this tour."
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Which is rather brilliant.
It kind of plays to that thing again about this track leading the way into Never Let Me Down, doesn't it? And that era, Glass Spider, that era, you know, so is the link in the chain that takes us there. We've been through this album. We've been speaking for nearly 3 hours, and remarkably, the album is 35 minutes long.
Yes, it's a short album.
It's a very short
there
album.
There is plenty to talk about, isn't there? It has features of interest, does it not? A few remaining features of interest. This is an interesting thing. Bowie was generally a big fan of the fade out. A lot of his famous songs fade out.
Yes.
On this album, very unusually, every track has an ending. I'm not sure if there's another Bowie album that can make that particular boast. You know, they all end. None of them fade out. Is that the influence of the patch? I've no idea. But that's an interesting little thing, isn't it? So that was something I just noticed while we were doing it. And we kind of mentioned the design. I just want to say a little bit about that because I think, again, the aesthetic of Tonight, I think, is rather nice. There's Mick Haggerty, the graphic designer. He'd been doing record sleeves on and off for a decade or so already. And by the end of the 70s, he was quite a go-to designer. He did the famous cover for Breakfast in America, the Supertramp album.
Was him.
And he'd also worked with the Police, by the way, but the Padge is not the connection because he'd already worked with Bowie. He actually did
which Police album?
I think he did Ghost in the Machine.
Right, that's iconic.
Yeah, he may have done some others, but I'm pretty sure he did Ghost in the Machine. And he was the design maestro for all three of Bowie's EMI solo albums of the 80s. So Let's Dance, Tonight, and Never Let Me Down were all Mick Haggerty's work. Quite an elaborate designer, but I quite like the Tonight aesthetic. On the single covers as well, you know, as well as the album itself, there's a kind of continuity across them, this idea of sort of stained glass and echoes of sort of Gilbert and George. I think it's a very handsome album cover. Again, very 80s looking. I mean, it is this.
Very 80s looking. And of course, I think a lot of people would look at that and assume it was a Gilbert and George artwork. You know, he's there, the stained glass, which is a very Gilbert and George motif, and then the face looking upwards. But it's not, is it? It was inspired by another artist, the name I've forgotten, but I did read about in The Complete David Bowie.
Yes.
Was it a Chinese artist?
I think it is, and I've gone over...
Yes.
See, I wrote it all down in my book, so I didn't have to remember it anymore. You're right. It is inspired by someone else. And, you know, we will never run out of finding out about artists that David Bowie admired. And when I say artists, I mean all sorts of artists, but certainly painters. The number of people who, you know, people who have slightly fallen under the radar, but were actually as far as we're concerned, as Bowie fans, you know, but were really important. People like Derek Boshier, who worked on Lordship. It has completely gone from my mind to, sorry, someone will write in and tell us. But yes, so there it was. It was a number one album. It was only number one for a week, but it was a number one album.
As Chris O'Leary rather pointedly explains, it was a number one album until everyone heard it.
Oh,
and then
what a thing to say. No, true that. Yeah, it was knocked off the number one spot in the UK by The Unforgettable Fire, the U2 album.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. What it knocked off, by the way, was the incredibly long reign of Now That's What I Call Music 3 or something. One of those albums, anyway, had been number one for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And then so tonight had this little moment in the spotlight.
It's just amazing to think, isn't it, how the anticipation for this album must have been so high. Anticipation would be absolutely at fever pitch. And then Blue Jean comes out. It's a great tune. Jazzing for Blue Jean comes out. It's funny. It's brilliant for all the reasons we've just mentioned. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah. And then the fall, well, it wasn't total. I mean, I think, you know, people did like Loving Alien the following year, but it was no Let's Dance. It was Let's Dance had three massive hits one after another, didn't it? And then that didn't really happen with this. And as you said earlier on, you know, there's definitely a palpable sense with this album that, you know, perhaps for the first time in his career, Bowie was no longer leading the pack. He'd kind of stepped off that extraordinary sort of time warp corridor of his, you know, that where he just seemed to be a step ahead of everything. And I would argue that he was right back on it again by the beginning of the next decade, you know. But in the context of that year, 1984, tonight does not feel like cutting edge album.
It really doesn't. I mean, it's somebody just, like you said, stepping back and absorbing what's happening around him and just being content with that, really. It's a holding pattern. I think it basically is just fulfilling that contract, which he was already feeling very uncomfortable about. Yes.
Which and the audience. Which a year or two before he'd been so excited about signing, getting so away from RCA. And things. But yeah, you know, the Bowie who had given us Ziggy and Berlin and Scary Monsters, that Bowie in 1984... would have been sizing up against artists like The Smiths and The Cure and of course Prince, who we mentioned earlier. Prince was absolutely in the ascendant, and indeed Frankie Goes to Hollywood, all this sort of thing. But tonight sounds more like he's content to compete with, you know, I don't know, Duran Duran or something. And look, nothing wrong with Duran Duran or Wham. I love those bands, truly. No,
I mean, there's nothing wrong with those bands, but it's a different audience.
Exactly.
It's a different set of values.
That's exactly
and
it. I mean, I guess in mid-80s parlance, it's sort of the difference between positioning yourself as a melody maker artist or a smash hits artist, as it were.
Yeah.
And seeing David Bowie kind of becoming a smash hits artist. It was a strange moment, particularly as, of course, Smash Hits, gloriously irreverent as it was, immediately started taking the mickey out of him, and they're the ones who came up with Dame David Bowie. And so, you know,
Dame David Bowie. I think you mentioned in the book, you mentioned that wonderful Tom Hibbert quote, was that, well, if he is such a bleeding chameleon, why is he in the skin of an aging, boring old rock star or something?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, which is, you know, it's harsh.
But I mean, this is the backlash that he got.
Of course,
I think there was a sense of betrayal from the hardcore of Bowie fandom who had been with him since Ziggy or before and had, you know, gone with him via Ziggy through Young Americans, through Station, into Heroes and into Lodger and Scary Monsters. And now it's like, well, you've left us for, you know, to sell out.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and that's how fans think, isn't it?
It is.
You know,
it is. Well, when fans love something so much, they also feel entitled to. When there's a bit of it that they don't like, and you know, I've seen this with you know, because as you know, I'm involved in the wonderful world of Doctor Who as well, and Doctor Who fans are exactly the same as David Bowie. It all went downhill when such and such a producer took over. It's kind of, you know, the same thing. And everyone's got their favorite period and their favorite bit and their favorite personnel, exactly the same thing. And when fans don't like a bit, it's because they love the whole thing so much that they feel entitled to hate the bit that they, you know, to really hate the bit. I guess this is why I'm always supporting the underdogs, because I don't think that this is a better album than Low. Of course I don't. But I do think that it's worth having a listen to. And I think it's because everything that he did was interesting. What was compelling and fascinating about him as an artist didn't desert him when he was making one of his slightly less brilliant albums. And, you know, the brilliant bits of this, which I think, as we've talked about, I mean, perhaps the most brilliant thing to come out of this album is actually the film, Jazzing for Blue Jean, you know. And the brilliant bits of this are still as brilliant and as fascinating as anything you'll find anywhere else. And I think we're missing golden nuggets of Bowie if we just ignore these albums and don't give them any consideration. So, you know, yes, as I said earlier on, it is not his best album, but David Bowie's sort of, you know, an iffy David Bowie album is still something that's worth listening to, because it's still a David Bowie album. And in the final analysis, for all its faults, for all its obvious faults, I love this album. I really love it.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for that wonderful tribute and exploration of tonight.
Well, thank you. It's been fun to talk about it. And
it really has. I think had you not asked to talk about this album, it would have lain sadly unlistened to for many, many more years. And I'm very grateful that, you know, you inspired me to pick it up again and give it a listen. Because, yes, it is, while there are moments on this album that I, as you can tell, don't adore.
Yeah, there are God Only Knows fans out there sobbing into their cornflakes at the moment. I mean,
I would genuinely like to hear from these people. Who are you? Identify yourselves. Stand up. I think it, as always with these things, that one has albums that one loves and one has albums which, you know, don't quite come off. But they're all part of a broader story. And of course, the story is what beguiles us and what keeps us coming back. And it, you know, it's the story of an artist in a constant state of flux and a constant state of movement. And if you have a duff album here and there, so be it. You know, you have to see it in a broader context.
Absolutely,
but it's something that is really, really important to go back and have a listen to, reevaluate, see what you think of it. Nick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Austin. Pleasure as always.
And that was the final part of our conversation on Tonight with Nicholas Pegg. And a massive thanks to Nick for his time and generosity in sharing his thoughts with me. While we're here, I'd also like to thank Leah Cardos for crafting, especially for the podcast, this gorgeous Bowie-adjacent music you're hearing right now. And of course, I'd like to thank all of you for listening and for all of those who've been in touch and also messaging, sharing this podcast on social media. It's all really very much appreciated. Keep an ear cocked for another batch of episodes coming very soon. But until then, thanks again and bye for now.